And good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Bastian. You're tuned to 89.3 WFPL, Louisville's NPR news station. And I'm joined this afternoon by Chris Stanek. He's professor of astronomy at Ohio State University, and he will present Measuring the Size and Age of the Universe. That's today at 7 p.m. in the Gein Science Hall in Roush Planetarium as part of the U of L's annual Bullet Lecture Series. Well, Dr. Stanek, thank you for coming in today.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. Well, this is obviously a big topic before we get to understanding the actual size of the universe. You have, I think, such a fascinating job. And I was wondering if you could begin talking a little bit about maybe some stories you have of growing up that maybe got you into the work you do right now. Do you remember something at a certain age that you recall that got you?
I actually remember quite well, because it was, maybe it's standard, maybe not, but I remember reading a science fiction book. I was probably 15. And in it, a boy was told to kind of orient himself towards a certain constellation. And I asked myself, you know, how come there's so many stars in the sky? How could you possibly know, you know, where the constellations are? So my father had this encyclopedia set of, I think, 13 tomes, and one of them had a star map. So I tore it off from the encyclopedia. He wasn't happy when he found out. And it took me a few days to kind of orient myself in the sky. And I, at some point, I actually started making sense. The constellations were there. It's kind of, at this point, makes me laugh, because it's kind of easy once you get the first step. But at the time, was you had to kind of do it for yourself. And I just kind of got hooked up. And in Poland, I'm from Poland originally, and there was this great program of actually astronomy camps during the summer. So I became involved in that. In fact, a few years later, I started running those for kids as well, you know, a few years younger than me. So it's kind of, already when I went to college, I knew I wanted to be an astronomer. In fact, back at the time, you pass entrance exams to college in Poland to study a specific topic. So I didn't have this luxury of 1 year kind of, you know, spending on campus. And but, I don't regret it. It worked for me well. So.
Do you ever feel like you're still doing science fiction even now?
It's amazing. Astronomy, 15 years ago now, I remember the first planet was discovered. I was still in grad school, 1995. And that was, wow, the first extrasolar planet. Now we have about 1,000, and the numbers just grow dramatically. And things that we thought, you know, we would never be able to do, now we do it routinely. So it's really a great journey, and you know, it's kind of privilege, and it's really good to be part of this.
Yeah. I want to come back to some of these questions that you're asking here, but let's jump to kind of what you're going to be talking about today. The lecture is called Measuring the Size and Age of the Universe, and it's a specialty of yours. It's trying to understand these questions. Now, size and age, these sort of seem like huge questions, and it makes me think of other questions of people sometimes talk about multiple universes. And so where do we begin with this question and this topic
talk is kind of, I talk about history, how we, in fact, Edwin Hubble, who actually used to live in Louisville at some point about 100 years ago, said that the history of astronomy is the history of the, you know, measuring distances. And the universe keeps growing, not because keeps growing for us. We started with this very small universe where there was Earth and some planets and the Sun. And then gradually over now, you know, more than 2,000 years, we realize the universe is truly vast. And yet, you know, it's finite in the sense that it's not infinitely large and it's not infinitely old. So actually, maybe first time in human history, now for the last 100 years, we actually can tell the universe is about 14 billion years old. It's very old, but it's a finite age, hasn't been around forever. We also now, maybe in the last 15 years or so, we actually get a pretty good idea what's the future of the universe. I will also talk about briefly what's the future fate. And, you know, I won't give up anything. This was a Nobel Prize last year. The universe actually is going to expand forever, as far as we understand. And this kind of will end up with a whimper.
I mean, so these are all such huge questions and hard to wrap your head around. But if we can age a universe, then say 14 billion years, like you said, what would possibly exist before 14 billion years?
So physics doesn't answer that question. So that's just, people always ask me, is that a proof there was God? But the truth is, science doesn't answer that question. Mm. We have physics laws that can take us all the way almost to the time equals zero. And we know the universe was extremely dense, it was extremely hot. The particles didn't even exist. They only kind of came into existence after the Big Bang. And then slowly, gradually cooled down. Some elements showed up. Hydrogen was formed. Helium was formed. And then the stars and galaxies showed up really much later. That's millions of years after the Big Bang. And then, of course, you know, Earth was formed about 4.5 billion years ago. So we are kind of two-thirds of the age of the universe, the Earth wasn't around, and we're a relative newcomer. But we're not, you know, we're not teenagers. We're kind of middle-aged compared to the age of the universe. And so from the science point of view, we don't answer the question because we just, you know, science is about data. We don't have any data before the Big Bang. If somebody comes up with a great new idea, that, of course, would be very exciting, and that would be great.
Well, yeah, of course. We would all love to hear that. But you talked about the future of the universe. That sounds interesting to me. I mean, so we hear questions of universe expanding sometimes. What do you see, or what does the data show us about that?
So again, 20 years ago when I started grad school, the future fate of the universe was, there were a number of possibilities. We know we are expanding now, but maybe the universe would expand for a while and shrink, start shrinking again, or would continue expanding forever. And then in 1998, and this was actually Nobel Prize in Physics last year in 2011, people have discovered, astronomers have discovered, that the universe not only expands, but actually expansion is accelerating. So somebody is actually pushing on the gas, and the universe is, the expansion is speeding up.
Yeah.
And that really means the universe will just expand forever. And everything, the distance between any two objects, between any two galaxies, will just keep increasing. And that's where I said this kind of ends with a whisper.
Right, right.
Or a whimper, rather.
This question of expansion, you said something earlier, which is that, is it an issue that we're beginning to see more and more space? It gets further and further out? Or is there seems like there's something on a physics level which makes things are literally expanding? Because you said earlier that our concept of what the universe was limited because we could only see so far and know so much.
So first, our understanding of the universe is expanding. Namely, we now know how big it is. And now we also know fairly recently that it's accelerating, not just expanding. But also in reality, the universe is becoming bigger, although, you know, this is not something you can measure in my lifetime.
Right.
Universe will double in size, you know, in another 14 billion years, it will be twice as big. So that's roughly speaking. But then because of the acceleration, then at some point very far in the future, the universe kind of goes into a runaway stage when we will not be able to see any galaxies except a few nearby galaxies. But that's really, we're talking about, you know, many, many, probably trillion years from now. I haven't actually checked that. But
yeah.
This is, on the short time scale, we see more and more of the universe because the light, we can get more light from farther away. And also because the light travels with finite speed, we can actually see, it's pretty cool, we can see back into the past. When we look at very far away objects, we see them as they were a very long time ago. So astronomers have the luxury actually of time travel, but only one way.
Right.
Namely, we get to see things as they used to be, you know, early on in the universe.
One of the big discoveries right now is of course, what's happening on Mars. And I remember asking you earlier, and we joked about this, which is that a lot of people are talking about what's happening, what we're finding there. And you were saying, of course, and it was my mistake to realize that an astronomer is actually quite different than the work that's going on in Mars, in a sense, and that you're always looking out to take data, whereas other people are going to actually collect data. Talk a little bit about that distinction here.
Sure. So for astronomer, you know, we are basically forced because the objects are so far away, even the nearest star, the light takes about 4 years to travel to here. We are forced to, we're kind of passive. We have to build bigger and bigger telescopes because we have to wait for photons to get to us. So I'm actually quite envious of my planetary sciences colleagues who get to build machines and send them on Mars. And this is really cool. We don't get to do that. We cannot send a probe to a nearby black hole or neutron star. That would be extremely nice if we could
right.
do that, but it's just we don't have the technology. And, you know, it would take a very long time unless somebody invents faster light travel. But at the same time, astronomy has, you know, despite this limitation, we had a huge progress because our understanding of the universe, we get to bigger to build bigger telescopes, but also it's kind of people get clever about how to use the few photons that we get. So really it's science. The neat thing about science is that we really stand on the shoulders of giants, but sometimes they're not even giants. They're just ordinary people who used to be, you know, scientists. And it really is a collective effort. It's not just one genius or two geniuses kind of making the breakthrough. It really is a number of people in astronomy. There's probably about 6,000 astronomers in the world kind of working together, writing papers, debating, arguing, you know, sometimes heatedly. But
right.
it's a process. So sometimes the process is kind of even how to get an answer is even more important than what the answer is, because as we do that, we get to learn new things. We get to reform the question. It's kind of, I really enjoy it. It's, you know, I've been doing it for 20 years, but
right.
it's almost like every day there's something new, and it's really exciting. So.
What do you think has been the biggest discovery in the past 10 years that's really affected the way we think about the universe when we look out to the sky?
So really, 98, the accelerating universe, I mean, it's a little bit more than 10 years, but that's a huge thing, because until then, it was a possibility, but people really didn't take it seriously, because what it means is that the 75% of the universe is composed of something that actually behaves like anti-gravity. Normally, if I throw a ball up in the air, it will come down. If I had a really strong arm, you know, I could throw a ball at 11 kilometers per second. The ball would never come back. It would continue going. But here, there is some process by which the ball actually not just goes up, but goes up faster and faster and faster. And so in the universe, 75% of the stuff in the universe is composed of what we call dark energy. But basically, this just means we don't know what it is. We have no physical idea. Now, the additional 23% or so, 22%, is stuff called dark matter. This behaves like normal stuff. It has gravity. But again, we have no idea what it's made of. So about 3% of the universe is made of things like this table or the wall or like us, of normal baryons. But the rest of the universe is some other stuff. So dark matter plus dark energy, they're really the two huge questions. And it's not clear that astronomy will answer what they are. Maybe it will be particle physics. Maybe somebody will find out in the lab. But these are huge.
Yeah. This issue of funding, I know, comes up in a lot of the different, you know, in universities, whether or in NASA. But what kind of an argument do you have when they go before Congress, they go in front of a budget, a university, and say, you guys are working on these incredible, but for some people, kind of crazy ideas that are happening right now that we have a hard time understanding? How do you defend the practice and the money that goes into these kind of the work you do?
So there was a Nobel Prize physicist who was asked, you know, how does this contribute to the defense of the country? How the science contributes to the defense of the country. And he said, it makes the country worth defending. And I say astronomy, you know, we don't make cars, we don't make computers, we don't, you know, produce stuff that people use every day. But anytime I give a talk, there will be, you know, a few hundred people asking questions. People really want to know, what is the age of the universe? How old the universe? How big the universe? Was there a beginning? These are kind of fundamental questions. Yes, you can live without them, but the truth is, you know, there's about 6,000 astronomers in the world. So there's a very small fraction of the population. Yes, we would like to have bigger telescopes. We would like to have the next space telescope, because the truth is, if we don't have these, we don't answer these questions. We basically will not only stagnate, but the truth is, new people will not come to the field. People will go do something else, just because, you know, if there's no new big questions to be answered, no ways to answer them, the science stagnates. I'm kind of fond of history. My father used to be a history teacher. Roman Empire was technologically great, but they actually never had good science. Greeks had science. Romans didn't. I don't want to draw analogies, but I think if they put more money into science, I think they would maybe still be around. In a sense, this is kind of far-fetched. But science, you learn how to answer questions, but how to pose questions. But we are kind of trained always to ask questions and always answer questions. It's not really... It's a mindset.
Yeah.
And you know, so it's a priority for the country. From my point of view, if you decide science is not a priority anymore, then you basically say, I will just kind of coast. I will not really asking new big questions. And you know, that if the country decides to do that, that's a choice.
These big questions, obviously they hit on a lot of things, whether they're religious, like we were talking about earlier, or philosophical or conceptual or psychological. And something you mentioned when we were talking earlier was that, of course, there's the day-to-day work that you do, where it's a lot of data and it's papers and it's conferences. But of course, I think part of the fascination in the work that you and your colleagues do is they ask these great questions. Do you ever find time to step back and think about the greater implications of the work you're doing?
It's actually like opportunity here when you give public talks are great, because then when you have people, you know, sometimes people say, oh, I never actually heard the universe is expanding. And that kind of gives you the moment of, oh, okay, you know, I remember when I first kind of realized how important it is, and you couldn't sleep all night because you were kind of thinking about, you know, the deep implications of it. The truth is, I still have these moments in everyday life. And also, we all have these moments when we kind of figure out something. And you know, we figure out something that nobody else has figured out before. And that's really why you do this job. It's like, wow, I know something nobody else knows. Of course, sometimes you're wrong, but that's part of the job.
Yeah.
But it's you know, it's a really great job. Of course, you know, most of the time, yes, I sit in front of a computer and analyze data, talk to graduate students. But now and then you have this moment when you learn something new, and you're super excited about it.
Well, then let me ask you a funny question. Do you see among your colleagues that does it affect people in their personal or even religious lives? I'm curious. Do you find that astronomers tend to be ones that are interested in questions of religion because you are posing such big questions, or they're actually quite irreligious as a result?
So we have in our department, to my knowledge, we don't really discuss religion on a daily basis, not because we could, it's just we usually discuss astronomy. But as far as I know, we have Catholics, we have Protestants, we have Muslims, we have actually at least two. I am an atheist, but I was, raised Catholic. I mean, the good thing about astronomy is you can have people with very different religious outlooks, but if we all look at the same data, we most of the time anyway agree what it means. So really is kind of what I really like about science, that it is, as far as you can do it, it's objective.
Mm.
Yes, people can disagree. There are valid scientific debates. That's usually because the data is just not good enough. So usually that leads to better experiment, better telescope, bigger telescope, or sometimes smaller telescope. Sometimes you can actually do better discovery with a smaller telescope. Mm. But I think every day we don't really have, deep philosophical discussions. But now and then it's kind of, especially it's a, I really enjoy it, but it's also a challenging job. I mean, as you mentioned, funding cuts. Yes, I mean, right now we're doing well, but for example, the future of Hubble Space Telescope, what's next? If NASA has no budget, then it will be the sad feeling that we already peaked, that, the astronomy has sort of, it's now past the golden age and we're kind of declining. I really hope this doesn't happen, because it's not just for our sake. I mean, it's not for astronomers' sake. The public really cares. It's kind of amazing how people care about astronomy and these deep questions.
Absolutely. In the future, though, of this, the future, I'm curious, too. What do you see as, of course, this is still one of the great frontiers left, but in terms of the immediate future, let's say 5 to 10 years out, what are the major discoveries out there that you feel you're on the cusp of, or your colleagues are on the cusp of?
So in the extrasolar planets business, it really has been, it's amazing. People, again, I mentioned the first extrasolar planet was discovered about 15 years ago. Now people are starting finding planets which are almost like Earth, and especially the Kepler satellite, which is in space. It has really opened a new window of discovery. And this is a very clever idea, that the Earth, Earth passing in front of the sun would just make sun slightly dimmer. And if you observe enough stars for long enough time, you actually will be able to statistically speaking, find Earths out there. And they're actually doing that. Again, first time when I heard about it in the 90s, I thought it was basic science fiction. And now there's a satellite space, has been up there for 3 years. They get the data, they analyze the data, and they find these things. And so we're now, one of the things we had no idea even 10 years ago, and now we have a pretty good idea, what is the statistics? How many extrasolar planets out there? Does every star have a planet or a number of planets? And the answer is most of the stars out there actually have planets. And that's something we had no idea until a few years ago. And 10 years from now, we'll really have a good statistics of extrasolar planets, for example.
Well, Dr. Stanek, thank you for coming in and talking to us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Stanek, Chris Stanek is the professor of astronomy at Ohio State University. He will present Measuring the Size and Age of the Universe. That's today at 7 p.m. at the Gein's Science Hall and Roush Planetarium as part of U of L's annual Bullet Lecture Series. And we'll have this interview online later at WFPL.org. Again, Jonathan Bastian joined by Dr. Stanek on WFPL 89.3.